and we hope that you hear something that might encourage you to keep coming back. Okay, so like I said, we're a speaker meeting this evening. It falls on me to introduce him. I've known this particular person for probably quite a few years, one way or another, online. And I'm grateful to him in particular for, how can I put this, opening my eyes and introducing me to a broader understanding of the nature of our fellowship over the years. And that's a journey that I've been on, that I've kind of where I'm at these days. And then we had the pleasure of meeting actually face to face 18 months or so ago, to discover that we both use different names. I guess I'll let him share anything about that if he wants to. But and he's just celebrated a fairly major milestone in recovery yesterday. So without further ado, I'm going to hand you over to Bill, who's going to share with us 40, 45 minutes on anything he'd like to share about in respect of his recovery and his journey in Narcotics Anonymous. So over to you, Bill. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Steve. Mine's Bill. I'm an addict.
Hi, Bill.
Welcome to the meeting.
Thank you very much. And I'm in the right place, you know. I don't have a recovery watching the football, or watching the film, or going to the dance. Although I do all those things, but I don't have a recovery there. I have a recovery here in these meetings with you people, because you're the only people who know what it's like for me, because you're addicts as well. You know, well-meaning people who, you know, have tried to help. It's like my mother. She said, "Bill, you haven't used anything for 10 weeks now. Do you still need to be going to those meetings?" And I had to say to her, "Look, Mum, the thing is, if I didn't go to these meetings, what would happen is I'd start forgetting all the stuff that I've been told, or the things that I've come to understand in these meetings. And it wouldn't be very long before my addict would say to me, 'Look, Bill, you've done 10 weeks now. You've shown that you can control your drug use. Now let's get back to some serious using, shall we?'" You know, that's what the voice in my head will be telling me, you don't need to go to them meetings anymore because you're cured. And one thing my first sponsor was very careful to tell me was that it doesn't matter how long it was from your last one, it's how near you are getting to your next. And that's the most important thing. And the other thing he told me, he said, "Bill, you've got a relapse 1 minute past midnight. And it's, if you forget you've got a relapse, you're on the way to one." And and I understood that. I'm so glad that he drummed into my head right at the start that this is a daily program, and that I don't have to think about not using for the rest of my life. I don't even have to think about not using 1 minute past at midnight. All I have to do is today do what's required to maintain my recovery, whatever level that is for me at a particular time. One of the things that was so important to me was that I didn't have to think about all those things. And, you know, let's put it this way. Yesterday, I was 30 years clean. But, you know, today I have to do what's required to maintain my recovery. It's all very well me saying about all those, you know, what was it? It's 10,958 days or something. That's great. I've chosen to maintain my recovery for those number of days. If I don't choose today, my relapse comes from 1 minute past midnight, right up into my face, and I'm the kind of person, you know, sometimes I go to a meeting and somebody who's just come off the street says something to remind me, and I think, how the hell did I forget that? You know, that's the other thing. My head's like a sieve. What happens when I go to a meeting is that I'm reminded of all those things that I need to remember. If I don't go to the meetings, you know, one bit drops away and then another bit drops away. I'm so glad that over the years that I've been in recovery, there hasn't been many weeks when I haven't been to a meeting. I think there's probably something like, let me think, probably something like, in the 30 years, something like 10 weeks where I haven't been to a meeting. Most of the time, for those years, I went to at least two, or more or less three meetings a week, depending on, you know, where I was living and my sort of work schedule and all that kind of stuff. Now I go to five because there are five meetings in there are six meetings actually in our town now, and I go to five of them. I find that that's just about the right kind of ratio for me. The other thing is I come from a place in England, East Lancashire, and when I was growing up, it was like it was a society that was cut down the middle. It was the men were on one side and the women were on the other, and the men worked hard and the women worked hard as well. It was a weaving place, and in those days men and women who were married or not married and living together worked in the weaving mills, and they often, if they had kids, they were on opposite shifts. So it's six to two and 2 to 10. So my mum might be on 6 to 2 and my dad would have been on 2 to 10. The people in charge of the mills usually let people who had children off 10 minutes early so that they could swap over with their spouses about the children, but mainly, you know, we were brought up by the people in the street. You know, my dad would take me to one of the ladies in the street who'd give me my breakfast. My mum would pick me up from there, you know, when she came out of the mill. So it was a very, very working class area. You know, it was like you know, the working men's clubs were that they were the games room. You know, it's not quite like this, but you know, like there might be a sign over the door saying no women in here since 1873, and that were a cleaner. You know, they it was a very male orientated place. Like the games room, there was a snooker table, there was dominoes table, there was card table, and on Thursday night, you were paid on Thursday, and on Thursday the men went into that room and started to gamble. You know, a lot of them used to gamble their, you know, their week's wages away. There were fights, you know. I come from Lancashire, but the Yorkshire advice to the son is eat all, drink all, pay note. Hear all, see all, say note. And if you ever do out for note, make sure it's for your sen, which means yourself. If you do anything for nothing, make sure it's for yourself. And that was the attitude. You know, the Lancashire advice to his son. My dad took me out when I was 18 years old, because that's the legal age for drinking. So that was the first legal time I could go out with my dad for a drink. And he took me around what's called the Barbary Coast, which was the dirtiest, darkest dives in the whole area. to show me, what goes on. The legs of man, where the professional ladies plied their trade, the black horse, where it was that was the place where all the real alcoholics went. He bought me a pint, and he said, "Right, you bought that pint. That pint's yours. Fight starts in corner. How do you get that pint down your mouth before fight arrives?" So my dad's best advice to me was to say to me, "Before the fight arrives, you've got to get that pint down your neck." And he showed me how to do it. You put your head up, you open your neck, and you pour it down. That was my dad's advice to me. My dad could drink me under the table any day of the week. But the funny thing was, he wasn't an alcoholic. That is something that I later understood, that people can drink and people can use. Some people can take it and leave it. They can have it and then, not bother for 6 months. I'm not that kind of person. What I had to understand was that no amount of mind-altering chemical, whatever it's called, whether it's a liquid drug or another kind of a drug, it's not possible for me to use that safely, because I will always become obsessed to use more. It's like the cliche, my drug of choice was more, and it was. The other thing was that I can remember looking out of my window on a Sunday morning, 6 o'clock, where all the beatniks, it was beatniks in those days, they went to the jazz clubs, and in the jazz clubs they heard trad jazz, and they might have heard modern jazz, but they also heard blues, because that's where the blues came in through into England, through the jazz clubs. And a lot of the jazz bands had a kind of a two or three blues song. They do a two or three blues songs in a night. So I'd look out of the window and I'd see these people with that kind of mod kind of haircut, long leather coats, faces white as sheets, staggering in from the jazz club, and I decided before I'd even touched anything, that's what I was going to be like. I'm going to be one of them, I thought to myself, because I'd become ashamed of who I was. I'd become ashamed of my family. I used to have fantasies about, these people aren't really my parents. I must have been stolen at birth. Anything to kind of distance myself from my family and from that culture. That culture was very one-sided. It was you work, you go out on a Saturday night and you get pissed. On a Sunday, you go down the bar again, and on Monday morning at 6 o'clock, you're punching on to do a week's work. I wasn't like that, First of all, I was good at art, so in school they told me that you should be an artist. My father, for all the stuff that I kind of held against him for many years, when I told him that's what I wanted to do, he wasn't a man who could put his hand in his pocket and pay for me to do that. But what he said to me, he said, "Bill," he said, "you're going, and I'm going to work so that you can go." He was committed so much to education. That was the one thing that my dad had in his favour, was he was committed to education, and he put me through art school. And I'll never forget that, and I will always be grateful. The problem was that also in those times, there's always a dance craze, and when I kind of was a bit older, it was soul music. It was Tamla Motown. It was Stax Records. It was Atlantic Records. It was Sam and Dave. It was the Muscle Shoals band. We went out, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all weekend, dancing to soul music. and put no finer points on it to keep that kind of level up. You need to be putting something in you, and that thing that we put in us was all kinds of various types of speed. So there was the brown bombers, there was the black bombers, there was the dexedrine, there was the French blues, there's the green and clears, there was the black and whites, there was every kind of single variation of pharmaceutical speed that you can think of. And in the town where I was born, there was a pharmaceutical company called Cupels, which made dexedrine. So the amount of plastic bags of dexedrine that came out of that place is unbelievable. We all had it, and we all used to knock them out, a shilling a tab, which meant that a quid deal was 20, because there's 20 shillings in a pound, and that would do you for the weekend. Five on Friday, five on Saturday, and five on Sunday, and five to bring you down on Monday morning. That's what we did. We went out there. I was in a band called the Clique. We played surf music first half and soul music second half, and it was all fueled by speed. If it had a lot of my friends, when they became 18, 19, and 20, all that paled insignificance. They were more interested in finding a woman and getting married and having a family. For me, that wasn't the case. I became committed to a life of drugs. And as an art student, the art schools in the 60s and 70s were basically offices to use in. When I went to the main art school in the south of England, the head of department had been a Fulbright scholar in California in the 60s, and he was the dealer for the college. We had an end of term trip out in a 15-seater minibus, and 14 of us were tripping, and the driver was stoned. And how the hell we ever got back, I've got no idea. It was insane. I managed to scrape through and get I got a degree, basically, because I painted some pictures in the last sort of 6 or 9 months, and I did some kind of I did some performance art. So I got through, and then what we did, we all went into the communes. Then it was peace and love, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We're going to change the world. It was 68 had already happened. The revolution, the revolution had been stopped. I think in America, the 68 was the Democratic convention that was smashed up. In Europe, it was, the French students had taken over France, but pretty soon the CRS took it all back, and so there was a sort of like a lull up to about 1970, where all that kind of rhetoric, we're gonna create a better world, we're gonna sex and drugs and rock and roll, and there's gonna be a revolution, and we're gonna be right in the front of it, and it's gonna be fantastic. It's just another bloody excuse to use. And I found, later when I look back on it, that's all that rhetoric and all that kind of political and spiritual and religious kind of thinking that went along with a lot of that. I mean, some people were genuine, and I think the genuine people didn't use. But it was just another excuse to use more drugs. And at the end of my art school, and I mean this, my friends started to die off. They literally started to die, because it was opiates. I was on them as well. I thought I'd better stop this, or else I'm gonna die. I don't know how the hell I did it, but I do know how I did it. I changed one drug for another. I changed the brown drug for the white drug, and so I was able to stop my opiate use. It probably stopped me from dying, but it certainly didn't stop my addiction. The problem with the drug that I then went on, it makes you into an arrogant prat. It makes you think you're fucking invincible, and it makes you think that you're better than anybody else around. And that's what it, that's exactly what it did to me. My use of it went more and more and more. The funny thing is that I got a really good job. I became a lecturer in an art school, which in those days, if you were, as long as you kept your use to a particular level, people would overlook your drug use. It didn't do us any good. It didn't do me any good, because what it did to me is it made me into a homicidal maniac. I'll give you an instance. The time when my wife left me and never came back, I'd been using for a few days. I decided the best way thing to do would be to drink a bottle of rum to bring myself down. But what I didn't know was that if you drink alcohol with this other particular drug, it creates another drug in your bloodstream, which is worse than both of them singly. And when she came home, I attacked her. I got my hands round her throat, and if I hadn't have fallen over, I would have killed her. She managed to get away. She locked me into the house, and then I proceeded to smash everything in the house into small pieces with a hammer. I threw the television set through the front window. And basically, I went insane in a destruction frenzy. She left and never came back, and I don't blame her. What happened was I managed to clear the house out. Another woman came to moved in with me, and we moved somewhere else. We started a shebeen, which is like a kind of a drinking club, where we played music and sold drugs and alcohol. We had a long drive that came up to it, so we could see any cops who came, who were going to come up there, and we were fairly safe. The only problem was that I think it was probably about 18 months later, the same thing happened. I woke up. The room was covered in blood. The front door was caved in, and she'd gone. And this is where I believe that my higher power came into play. On the floor next to the door was a free newspaper, and on the back of that free newspaper, which was facing me. At the bottom, it said, "Do you have a problem with drugs? Ring this number between 7 and 8 on a Wednesday or a Saturday." Now, this was somebody in a service meeting in Bristol who'd said, "Oh, let's put that advert in the free newspaper and see if anybody, rings us." And I went down to the, in those days, mobile phones were like a brick, and you needed a little wheel along battery to go with them. So I went down to the phone box. I rang up. Somebody was sitting in that office next to the phone doing service. And they picked up that phone and I said, I saw your advert and I think I've got a problem with drugs. And they said, where do you give us your address and we'll send you some literature. And they sent me the little white book and four of the pamphlets. Am I an addict? For the newcomer, sponsorship, and I can't remember what the other one was, but it was basically I got the starter pack, and they said there's a meeting in Swindon on a Thursday night. If you can get there, that'd be great. So I lived in Devizes at that time, and there was a 49 bus there, but the last 49 bus back was something like 7 o'clock or 7:30 or something. And I said that, and they said, look, they said, you get to that meeting and somebody there will get you home. So I got on that bus and I went to that meeting, and when I walked in that room, the guy that became my first sponsor asked me my name and he gave me a cup of coffee. And he said, Bill, you don't ever have to use again. Now, that was the first time that anybody'd said that to me. That's the first time I'd understood that addicts could stop using. I looked around that room and there were men in that room and women in that room. They looked well. Their clothes were good. In those days, you could smoke cigarettes indoors. You know what I mean? They were smoking Camel cigarettes. They were wearing chinos and loafers and Ben Sherman shirts and I could smell it, I could see it, and I wanted it. I was sick and tired of dragging my sorry ass around from one deal to another and being potentially a murderer if in the right circumstances. I'm so grateful that didn't happen. That's not for... not because anything to do with me. I believe that was something to do with my higher power. Those people put me back together. Those people loved me until I could love myself. You know, money was drug tokens to me. The guy that I spoke about said, look, Bill, you need to get some clothes, get some decent clothes. Because my idea about clothing and laundry was to go to a jumble sale on a Saturday morning, pick some stuff up off the table, go to the toilet, change out what I was wearing, put what I was wearing back onto the table, and that was my idea about how to change some clothes. You know, I got those clothes. I did like a sort of a post to put them on, you know, and I had these Bermuda shorts which were like psychedelic, and he said, look, Bill, you wear those and you'll get bloody arrested. You know, I was taught how to live again. Now, stick with the winners. So there I was in the car, in the cafe after the meeting, you know, loafers, chinos, Ben Sherman shirt, drinking a latte, sitting next to my sponsor, who was dressed exactly the same, because I dressed exactly the same as him, smoking Camel cigarettes because that's what he smoked, supporting the LA Raiders because he did. You know, it was, and he turned to me in front of everybody and he said, look, Bill, you can't have my bloody recovery. You got to get one of your own. And that's something else that's important for me and why I think this program of Narcotics Anonymous is so good. We're not churned out as recovery clones. We become the people we're supposed to be because this program develops us along the lines of who we are. We don't have to be this or that or perform that or do this or be this or wear that or anything like that. We develop along the lines of our own personality. So important to me. And I saw that happening. I saw people, that guy said to me, look, Bill, do yourself a favor, come for a year and you'll not recognize yourself. And I didn't. The trouble was that 11 months in, My sponsor said to me, "Look, Bill," he said, "it's you're great. You know, you've not used for 11 months." He said, "But you're stopping using drugs. You know, you've identified and you've accepted that you're an addict, but you've not surrendered because you still think that you can control drugs." He said, "If you still think that you can control drugs and you're and that it's you that's stopping using, you're gonna die." He said, "What you have to do is you've got to find something that's bigger and stronger than yourself and hand over all that stuff to it, because you're not strong enough to do that. You've proved to yourself for years, I used for 24 years. I proved myself for 24 years I had no control over drugs." And there's me thinking, "Oh, look, I'm 11 months clean. You know, I'm controlling these drugs very well." I'm sorry to have to tell you, Bill, that's not the case. So he said, "Go to the day program." I went on a day program, and that day program taught me a lot of things that I hadn't understood before. And but the main thing that I understood was that I needed to surrender. I had to stop fighting. I had to understand that it wasn't me that stopped using. It was and there was a power greater than myself that took away my desire to use. And he said, "Close your eyes and think of something big and strong." So I close, and this is what I saw. I'll tell you. I closed my eyes and I saw a dirty, great big water wheel that was rusted up and had all sort of, mold and stuff all over it. And he said, "Bill, make it move." I closed my eyes and I made that water wheel move. That was the first image I ever had of a higher power, and it started to move. And I've got my eyes closed now. That water wheel's still moving. You know, my idea, my concept of my higher powers developed from there, but it's still there. That idea of a big water wheel churning round was my first image, and it's still moving, and may it forever move, because that is the expression of my higher power working. But it wasn't just that. It was, it's the four legs of the table. It's sharing. It's sponsor. It's steps, and it's service. And that man put me through my first 12 steps, and made sure that I did service. I made sure that I got to enough meetings. The thing about it was, we the main meetings we went to were in Bath, which was a bit of like a party town, really. And we went out down after the Saturday night meeting. It was called Saturday Night Alive, and we went out dancing. We went to the clubs. We kept together. We didn't use. And he told me, he said, "Bill, we didn't get into recovery to be bloody miserable. We got into recovery to enjoy our lives." And we did. I'm so grateful that was the time that I was involved in it, and I really loved it. It was I can't tell you how grateful I am. I've got to show you how grateful I am by doing service and by getting to meetings. Everything sounds fine and dandy, doesn't it? Everything's wonderful. I've got me chinos on, and I've surrendered, and I've done me 12 steps, and blah blah blah. And then he moved away, and I got another sponsor, and then he moved away. And then I didn't get another sponsor. And then 11 years clean, I was going to one meeting a week. I didn't have a sp I was sponsoring myself. But yeah, come on, Bill, get a grip. And what happened was my wife, who my second wife, she got an injunction against me because I was getting out, because I was, I didn't use that. I think going to that one meeting a week made it so I didn't use. Was I in recovery? Nah, I don't think so. I was mad as a fucking hatter. And I don't blame her for getting out of that injunction. I went to the injunction meeting and the judge said to me, you've got an hour to go to your house, get out what you want. And then after that, you're not to be, go within 500 yards of her or the house. I was homeless. 11 years clean and I was homeless. But the funny thing was, I knew where to go. There was a 66 bus to Oxford. It was a Tuesday night, the Tuesday night meeting. I got on that bus. I walked around Oxford all day. It was like somebody turned the volume down. I got to that meeting and I burst into tears. I sobbed my heart out in that meeting and people put me back together. There was a guy in that meeting who was going to Canada for 6 weeks. He knew me. He knew that I'd been clean for some time and that I hadn't used. I might have been fucking mad as a hatter, but I hadn't used. He gave me the key to his flat and said, Bill, you can stay at mine while I'm away. I stayed in his flat. I didn't have any rent to pay, electricity to pay, or any of that to pay. All I had to do was get to a meeting and get something to eat. 3 weeks later, I realized that I'd never felt better in my entire life. I had nothing. All I had was the people in the meeting and the belief and the knowledge that I had a higher power that wanted the best for me. And that if I applied myself to this program, it would work out. I've never gone back to that thing. You know, there have been times when, you know, when my recovery, you know, Rocky Recovery and I can't remember what the band was called. It was something like that. I've never gone back to that, but sometimes I've needed help. The funny thing is that when I ask for help, my higher powers sent me somebody. I was really a few years later than that. I got into meetings and I'd started doing the steps again, and I had a sponsor, but I really needed some help, and I asked my higher power to help me. Two people in that week asked me to be their sponsor. That was the answer. Stop fucking thinking about yourself and start helping somebody else. Start helping a newcomer, and that's what happened. I took those two people on a sponsorship, and let me tell you that they did more for me than I could possibly have done for them. You know, it's a two-way street, is sponsorship, and I'm ever so grateful. And the other thing is that whenever I do ask for help, I'm 9 times out of 10, so I'm sent somebody to help. I think I'm probably gone over time now, have I, Steve?
5 minutes.
I've got 5 minutes, so that's good. Yeah, so that was then. The funny thing was that later on, because I understood that my behavior had become so bad that my ex-wife couldn't stand it anymore, I didn't hold it against her. And when we got divorced, we decided not to have lawyers. We decided we were going to sort it out ourselves, and we were going to be adults about it, and we were going to make arrangements for our two boys. And she stayed in the matrimonial home. I paid in because I was working again by then, and I had a good job, So I was able to, to pay the endowment mortgage, and I was able to contribute to, to the living of my two sons. And I never reneged on that, and I paid that money every single month while they were growing up. I never badmouthed her to them, and she never badmouthed me to them either. Our focus was the two boys and what was best for them. And I got a flat and I got a car and blah blah blah. I put my life back together. And the amazing thing was that my ex-wife found a new partner and wanted to go and live with them, and couldn't really do that because she couldn't leave our youngest son. Our oldest son had left. Our youngest son was about to go to art school, and he was 17. And that meant that he couldn't take over the mortgage or anything. And my ex-wife said to me, "Look, Bill, I want to move in with my new partner in Kent, which is about 150 miles away or something like that. If you move back into the matrimonial home, I'll sign it over to you." Now, you couldn't have manipulated that in a million years. How that happened was that I did the next right thing, and the whole thing came round in a circle. And I moved back in. I looked after my son while he was doing his preparation for his art school. He was doing a foundation. He did two foundation years. He was doing his foundation years, and then when he moved to Cardiff to do his proper degree, I waited until he'd finished his degree. And when he told me, he said, "Dad, I'm not moving back to Swindon. I'm going to stay in Cardiff. I'm going to make a life for myself here." I sold the house. I managed to pay off the mortgage, and I had just enough to have to buy this small place where I am now without a mortgage. It's like if I found in my life that just doing the next right thing brings everything round. That's not to say I have a perfect pro. I don't have a perfect program. Like I said, I forget. I'm an addict. I forget stuff. I can sometimes convince that thing you like doing, Bill, that you don't like to tell anybody else about. Let's carry on with that. You carry on with that, and that'll be all right, won't it? I had I, the funny thing was that I was looking at the Just for Today at some point, and it said, about secrets keeping you sick. Tell your sponsor a say something like tell your sponsor a secret. And I couldn't. It was there on the printed page. I spoke to my sponsor, and we sorted out that. I'm not going to go into it, but we sorted out that particular aspect of where my head was going wrong. And that's not the only place where my head goes wrong. My head goes wrong constantly, but I have the tools to address it, and I listen when other people tell me that they have concerns. And like it said, step 10, promptly admit when I've made a mistake. And so I'm able to kind of manage my insanity, and go from one day to the next, doing the things in that day that mean that I don't have to use again, and that I maintain my contact with my higher power. I'm not going to go into who my higher power is now. We've all got we've all got the right to have the higher power of our own choosing, and I'm not going to go into which mine is. mine's from a particular spiritual path, that's irrelevant. I was so lucky at one point where I had an atheist for a sponsor, because they were the only person around at that particular time. So I said, right, well, there we are. And they never tried to stop me from believing what I believed, and I never tried to stop them from, you know, believing what they believed. But the effect is, you know, they still took me through steps, and this program can be applied by atheists, by Buddhists, by Christians, by Hindus, by any sect that you can think of, or none at all, and it's possible to use it to find a spiritual path that enables us to maintain our recovery on a daily basis. And you know, like I said, I can't tell you how grateful I am. I have to show you. I have to show you by turning up. I have to show you by doing my steps, by doing service, and by making the newcomer, you know, the focus of the meetings. Because by doing that, I take my attention away from all the stuff that's going on in my head, and it focuses me on the program. And once I'm focused on the program, I ain't doing so bad. I'm grateful that you asked me to speak. I shared last night at the Friday night meeting. I shared on the Thursday meeting as well. You know, all I can say is that I hope I have the sense to carry on today doing what I'm supposed to do, and tomorrow to do the same. You know, I don't have to think about any other time apart from just today. And if what I do in the morning, I read the Just for Today. I do a prayer schedule, and then I do a meditation. It, you know, half an hour to an hour in the morning, you know, 5 hours, 6 hours, maybe more meetings a week. So what we're talking? We're talking 3, 8. Say 12 hours a week. I get my entire life back. I get the ability to do a job. I'm retired now, so I've got a pension. I don't have to do all that kind of stuff. So I've got my art studio, and I'm actually doing a residency with my son, who's also an artist. We're doing a 2-week residency in Cardiff on between the 9th and the 22nd of September this year. I did an ultraviolet installation for a music festival earlier on this year. I'm actually functioning as a full-time working artist. You know, from where I came from, it's wonderful. And I see this happening in all the people who stick around. You know, that thing about keep coming back. I'm just so glad I had the sense to keep coming back, even when I was fucked, and I was mad as a bloody hatter. I still had the sense to drag myself to one meeting a week, and that stopped me from using. And as long as I can not use, then I've still got an opportunity to get back on this program and make myself understand that my surrender is complete, and that I can hand over anything that I need to addressing to the God of my understanding. And I'll leave it there, Steve.